From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Most Americans didn't know much about Saddam Hussein until Iraq invaded Kuwait. But back in 1985, Elaine Sciolino wrote a cover story for the New York Times Magazine on Saddam's tyrannical rule. Now Sciolino has a new book about Saddam called The Outlaw State. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Iraq and about her own experiences as a woman journalist in the Middle East. Journalist Lou Cannon covered Ronald Reagan throughout Reagan's political career in California and in the White House. Coming up, we talk with Cannon about his new book, President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Thelma and Louise, the new buddy movie about two women. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli radio broadcasts say Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir has given an unfavorable reply to a letter from President Bush on a Middle East peace conference. Mr. Bush's letter sought to bridge the differences between Israelis and Arabs on peace diplomacy. The broadcasts quote U.S. and Israeli sources in Washington as saying that Shamir told President Bush that Israel would not allow the United Nations to have a role in a proposed Middle East peace conference. U.S. officials say that the Iraqi government has been illegally diverting food shipments meant for Kurdish refugees, but the United States appears to be at odds with United Nations officials over the seriousness of the problem. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said yesterday that food had been sent to Iraq by the UN's World Food Program meant for Kurdish refugees in northern Iraq, but it had been diverted to the government's food rationing program. The White House said this represented a cynical attempt by Saddam Hussein to buttress his regime's standing with the Iraqi people. But today, a UN spokesman seemed to contradict the White House. He said the Iraqi government had later returned the food and that the charges had been, quote, dramatized, all out of proportion. U.S. officials said they stood by their story. The dispute comes at a time when administration officials are fighting efforts to repeal the Iraqi trade embargo. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
There are signs that the long-running nuclear arms reduction talks between the United States and the Soviet Union may be close to a successful conclusion. Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Bezmertnik and Secretary of State James Baker are scheduled to meet in Geneva tomorrow. Christopher Powell reports for the BBC.
The United States and the Soviet Union have been trying to negotiate a START treaty since 1982. START stands for Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, the original aim of which was to cut the number of long-range nuclear missiles by 50%. This has since come down to 30%, which would nevertheless be a considerable reduction in the number of the world's most destructive weapons. So far, agreement on cutting the long-range nuclear arsenals has been held up by a row over cuts in conventional weapons and the number of troops deployed in Europe. Both the Soviet leader, President Gorbachev, and President Bush have said they want to conclude a deal on nuclear arms control. The main difficulty is simply how to make sure neither side cheats and conceals nuclear warheads in submarines it claims are only fitted with conventionally armed cruise missiles.
Christopher Powell reporting for the BBC. About 3 million people started voting in India's eastern state of Assam today. Balloting in India's national elections has now resumed after the assassination of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi on May 21st. Voting has been staggered to make it easier for security forces to prevent violence in troubled states. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 10.5 points to 29.94. This is NPR. NASA officials say it could take an unplanned spacewalk to fix a broken cargo bay seal on board the shuttle Columbia. During launch yesterday, a section of rubber seal and two insulation blankets peeled off. It could prevent the cargo bay doors from closing properly when the shuttle is trying to return to Earth. Engineers say the problem is no threat to the shuttle now. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has urged 30 prisoners on hunger strikes to stop their fasts. He says the prisoners have made their points and should not risk their health any further. 26 of the fasters who are demanding their release from prison have been hospitalized. The Human Rights Commission, a monitoring group, says they face permanent health damage. Sources said a number of the prisoners will probably be freed under an agreement between the ANC and the South African government. The first former East German government official to be sentenced under West German law received a 1.5-year sentence, Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Former Politburo member Harry Tisch was found guilty by a Berlin court of using union funds for private vacations. Tisch was head of the East German government labor union, the only one allowed by the communist government. The court was unable to prove charges that Tisch diverted union funds for further personal use. After the sentencing, Tisch said he's being punished as a scapegoat for the former communist regime. Tisch is the first member of the former East German communist government to receive a prison sentence. This spring, several other top-ranking East German officials were jailed to prevent their flight before their cases come to trial on charges of embezzlement and human rights violations. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Pope John Paul has dismissed suggestions that the Catholic Church wants political power in Poland. He warned his fellow Poles not to abuse their newly gained freedoms with lies and hatred. Prior to the Pope's arrival, opinion surveys showed most Poles are tired of the Church's role, particularly its attempts to have abortion outlawed there. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Elaine Shalino was the first woman to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini. She was later expelled from Iran. She was also briefly imprisoned in Syria and shot at in Beirut. But she says of all the countries in the Middle East, she's always found Iraq the toughest to penetrate and the hardest to like. She attributes that to Saddam Hussein, who virtually eliminated Iraq's Western educated elite and produced a generation of people who know nothing but propaganda and the rule of fear. She last visited Iraq 2 weeks before the war. Shalino has written for the New York Times since 1984 and is now a diplomatic correspondent in the Washington Bureau. She covered the war from Washington and continues to write about its aftermath. Shalino first reported on Saddam Hussein's brutal regime in a 1985 cover story for the New York Times magazine. Now she's written a book about Saddam's Iraq, and she calls it the outlaw state.
Well, I like to call Saddam an outlaw. A gunman. There are probably three different types of leaders in the Middle East. One is the Messiah. Ayatollah Khomeini was the quintessential Messiah. He had the ability to inspire people to action through his words, through his charisma. He may not have looked very charismatic to us, but this man led a truly popular revolution that has lasted now for 12 years. Another type of Middle Eastern leader is the merchant. This is the one that we're more familiar with. The guy we can talk to, the one that we can negotiate with. Assad is a merchant. He knows the rules of the bazaar. He knows what limits there are. He may use force, even like someone like Saddam, but he knows where to stop. Saddam is truly an outlaw. I like to think of him as a gunman. He's the kind of guy who robs the bank and then gets caught in the bank. The doors of the bank lock behind him, the alarm bells off and go off, and he has to decide, do I stay and shoot it out, or do I unilaterally retreat? And this is the way he grew up. This is the way he always was as a young Ba'ath Party leader, and this is the way he still is today. It's something that we really didn't understand about him.
Do you think he doesn't have skills to negotiate?
I think he's devoid of negotiating skills. I think that if you look at his personal background, it becomes very understandable. He grew up in a very, very small village that had no running water, not even a paved road. It was a very harsh existence. He never knew his father. He owned a gun from the time he was 10 years old. And you often read political biographies of Saddam Hussein that say he quickly rose through the ranks of the Ba'ath Party. Well, this didn't mean he was sitting in cafes in Cairo discussing the nuances of party politics or Arab socialism. He was the gunman. He was the hitman, the one who would raid the other Ba'ath Party leaders' safe houses and steal all the weapons. This is how he rose through the ranks.
Now, you were on to Saddam Hussein in 1985. You had a cover story in the New York Times Sunday magazine. This was when the United States and Iraq were reestablishing relations, which had been broken off after the Arab defeat in the 67 war with Israel. How did you get on to him? Maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but I don't remember seeing a lot written in the press then about what a horrible dictator Saddam Hussein was and what a dangerous leader he was.
I think that was the case because we in the West so much wanted to like Iraq because we hated Iran so much. This was the height of the Iran-Iraq war. We were still suffering from the post-hostage trauma, the American hostages that had been held captive for over a year in Iran. And there was really a willingness on the part of the United States government, as well as our allies and our Arab allies as well, to give Saddam the benefit of the doubt. I looked at it, though, through the specter of Iran, and because I had spent a lot of time in Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. And I remember the first time I went to Iraq, I really didn't like the place because it was such a difficult country to work in. And I realized that even in Iran, which was more difficult in many ways as a woman, you had to be covered, you had limited access, I felt freer because there were little holes through which you could move in order to penetrate the system. I found Iraq impenetrable, and I felt that we were missing the boat on Iraq and that we didn't quite understand who we were dealing with, and that Saddam Hussein was merely preaching a message of moderation, even though he was committed to a vision that was expansionist, and that I thought he would revert to once the Iran-Iraq war was over.
You went to Iraq right before the war started, about 2 weeks before the war. You were in Iraq and stayed there till just about the start of the war, right?
Yes.
How did it feel to be flying to Iraq at a time when really everybody would have been wanting to get out of there, not go there?
Well, I can't say that I was scared because I never felt in any physical danger flying back into Iraq. I think because I knew the country. I actually had a colleague who was there. There were a number of Western journalists there. And what one does when one is in a difficult situation is you cling together with your colleagues or with Western diplomats. And I did know some people in Baghdad. And I had already cabled ahead saying that I was coming. To me, it was much scarier, for example, flying to Iran with Ayatollah Khomeini on his plane when he went back to Iran during the Iranian Revolution, because we didn't know whether or not the Shah was going to allow us to land. It was much scarier flying a Soviet-made helicopter to the Iran-Iraq border and covering the Iran-Iraq war because the Iranians were trying to shoot down our helicopter. It was scarier driving around Lebanon during the time when the American Marines were in Lebanon. So I think that once I got to the airport in Amman and I saw that the plane was full, much to my surprise, with people who were wanting to go back to Iraq, even mothers and children, I felt much calmer, even though now I'm a mother of two and doing those other things I was not.
Did you feel bad picking up as the mother of two and flying to Iraq? I think this is the kind of thing that reporters really have to deal with.
I felt horrible.
Yeah.
And it has changed my view of being a war correspondent, which is something that I did for a number of years.
That was largely before you had children, that you were a war correspondent?
Yes, that's right.
And you don't feel like you'd want to do it now?
I think I would be very careful. And what I even do now is I weigh assignments. And I think to myself, do I really want to be away from my two children, who are ages 2 and 1, for a month? And is this assignment really worth it? Where before, when I was asked, would you please go to X country for 6 to 8 weeks, I would jump on a plane and go.
I know it's become something of a sport for Middle East experts to predict how long Saddam Hussein is going to stay in power. And for that reason, I regret asking you that question. Yet I'm really curious to see what you think, since you've been following his story for so long.
Until someone can prove to me that he has weakened, I'm going to think he's going to remain in power indefinitely. I have never thought that he was in risk of being overthrown. There's one thing you can say about the Middle East and be pretty sure that most things are going to remain the same. You know, we said during the crisis, or many Middle East experts said during the crisis, the Middle East will never be the same again. There are going to be all of these changes. Well, what are we seeing? We're seeing a lot of things remaining the same, including the fact that Saddam Hussein is in power. He's consolidated power. He's put members of his family in very important positions around him. He has circled the wagons the way he has always done in the past in times of crisis. He has a reliable elite Republican guard that did come through for him during a very difficult civil war. He's in good health. Iraq has been allowed back into the Arab League, so we have every reason to believe that Iraq will be assimilated back into the Arab fold in one way or another.
What do you see changing now in terms of how Saddam Hussein holds the reins of power? You wrote recently that he's talking about democratizing, but what he's really doing is bringing in a lot more of his family into mm-hmm. positions of power.
Well, one of the principles that I explain in the book, and I think it's a key to understanding Iraq, is the duality of terror and enticement. In Arabic, it's called tarhib and targhib. What we sometimes forget is that Saddam doesn't rule by terror alone. Terror is a crucial element, and it's an overriding element. But if he ruled by terror alone, then all the people of Iraq would have risen up against him, and he may have been overthrown. But he's able to entice the people, too. He buys off the Iraqi people, and there is a genuine segment of the Iraqi population that owes everything to Saddam Hussein. I think that's what you're seeing now with various moves towards democracy. You're seeing these negotiations that are going on now with the Kurds that may end up in some sort of accord that will give the Kurds more autonomy. There are promises to hold elections. There are promises to have a 7-year presidency. There is a commitment to have more freedom of the press, to lift the travel ban. I look at this, and as far as I'm concerned, it's all window dressing. I have not seen any real fundamental change in Saddam Hussein, in his behavior, in his conspiracy theory, in his propaganda.
My guest is New York Times reporter Elaine Shalino. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Elaine Shalino, and she reported on the war throughout the war. Mostly she was based in Washington, but for the 2 weeks prior to the war, she was in Baghdad. She's written a new book about Saddam Hussein and the Gulf crisis, and it's called The Outlaw State. You've traveled around the Middle East writing about most of the countries there. You've been doing that for years. What are some of the considerations that you have to take into account as a woman journalist traveling through the Middle East that a man probably would not have to worry about?
Well, this is going to sound very sexist, but the first thing you have to worry about is your wardrobe. When I go to a place like Saudi Arabia, I tend to wear long, loose-fitting dresses and a hat. It was interesting during the Gulf crisis.
A hat out of modesty? I mean,
yes.
Modesty in quotes.
Well,
you know?
A hat because I don't like to be stared at when I walk down the streets, and I want to walk down the street.
So a hat to cover your hair and
a hat
everything.
To cover my head, mm-hmm. and it gives you protection against the sun, but it also protects you from staring Saudis who are also on the street or Yemeni workmen who look and see a Western woman walking down the street in a funny-looking robe that isn't the same thing that a Saudi woman would wear. A Saudi woman wouldn't be walking down the street anyway. I've always erred on the side of caution and have always dressed very modestly throughout the Middle East. It just makes life easier. In Iran, I would cover my hair with a scarf and wear pants and then some sort of a knee-length robe over it. In a country like Egypt, I wouldn't wear a sleeveless dress, although you can wear regular clothes, as you can in a country like Iraq. So your first sensibility has to be, do I have a versatile, comfortable wardrobe that is, in certain countries, is not going to get me banned from getting into the Ministry of Information, and also is going to make me feel comfortable. Other than wardrobe, I have always found it easier to work in the Middle East than in, or easier than I think some of my male colleagues might even find it, because in most places you're still in the minority if you're a woman working in the Middle East. Although I think that what the recent Persian Gulf crisis has proven is that women can do anything, and it it has raised the sensibility not only of Americans, but of the Arab countries in which the women worked, that they, first of all, could be soldiers, they could be mechanics, and they could be journalists as well. So that this is probably the first time that a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, has had to confront so many professional Western women. And there may be some changes in the way they treat foreign women in the future, although I doubt there'll be many changes in how they treat their own women.
You had said that in some ways you thought you had it easier than your male counterparts in the Middle East. So in what ways?
Well, for example, I was once arrested in Syria and briefly put into prison there. But I was put into what is probably considered a four-star prison. It was a basement. It was a prison in the basement of a lovely villa in a residential neighborhood. I had a female roommate. We had a clean cell. There was even a little window in the corner. There wasn't any furniture, but the male prison guards made an effort to be gracious and polite, and they probably were more gracious and polite than they would be if I were a man. There have been other cases where I know it helped me to be a woman. For example, in Libya, I'm sure that I would not have interviewed Colonel Gaddafi a number of years ago if I hadn't been a woman.
Why not?
Because he likes women journalists, and he tends to give interviews to women reporters.
How do you mean that? I mean, does he try to seduce women journalists? You mean it on that level?
Yes, he does that too.
Did he try to seduce you?
He locked me in his office when the interview was over.
Oh, no.
And that's about all I ever tell about what happened that's about all I ever say about what happened in that room, because I don't know if I have to go back to Libya someday.
Oh my goodness. So, but you held your own, I take it.
I got out to tell the story.
All right, so this is an example of what your male counterparts probably don't have to go through.
There's one place where it's harder to be a woman reporter, and that's in Iran, because the Iranians still cannot deal with women traveling with men. For example, if at this stage I wanted to go to Iranian Kurdistan and visit the Iraqi Kurds, I might it might be difficult to travel to Iranian Kurdistan, because the Iranians would say there aren't enough facilities for you as a woman. Once I was not allowed to go to the Iran-Iraq war front on the Iranian side for that reason. They said no women are allowed to go to the front. And despite the fact I said, well, I was just allowed to go to the war front 2 weeks ago,
Yeah. They
said, well, the rules have changed. But this is a country where the separation of the sexes is still a factor.
I got to ask you one more thing about this Colonel Gaddafi scene. Did you threaten that you would write about it, that the world would know if he persisted?
What I said to him, and it's been a long time since I've thought about this, but I said to him, people say that you're a terrorist, and I don't know if it's true, but you are certainly terrorizing me right now. So I would feel a lot better if you unlocked the door and let me go.
Was that effective?
I think he got the point after a few minutes, yes.
One of the more amazing things that's happened to you is you managed to fly with the Ayatollah Khomeini from Paris to Iran when he was ending his exile. How did you get to do that?
Well, at the time, I was the junior member of a bureau, Newsweek magazine's bureau in Paris. It was a 5-person bureau, and I was the low person on the totem pole. And early in those days, in the early days of Ayatollah Khomeini's exile, nobody took him seriously. He was just looked at as still another political exile in Paris who had sought political asylum. And I, as the junior member of the bureau, went out and interviewed him very early on. And soon he became very important, and people who never knew what an Ayatollah was suddenly had to take him very seriously. So that when it came time to send someone on his plane back to Iran, Newsweek magazine put me on his plane. And not only put me on his plane, but let me stay in Iran for 2 months and cover that revolution. And it was one of the first times that Newsweek did allow a woman to cover that sort of story.
You said earlier in our interview that that flight back was one of the times when you felt you were truly in jeopardy. What was the most frightening part of that? What were the dangers?
When we neared Tehran, we had no idea whether or not the Shah's troops would allow the plane to land. Ayatollah Khomeini was the Shah's enemy. He was coming to foment revolution. And we circled the airport for, oh, half an hour, 45 minutes before we had landing rights. And we looked out over the airfield and could see the Shah's troops below us and had no sense whether or not we would be fired on, either in the air or when we landed on the ground. And even Ayatollah Khomeini knew that because it was a conscious decision to take journalists on that flight with him. And we were his first hostages, in a sense. And when it came time for us to disembark, the journalists got off the plane first.
Oh, wow. So he was, like, in a way, hiding behind the journalists.
No question.
When you were on the plane with him and when you were talking with him, did you feel like you had to wear the veil that Iranian women wear? And I ask that because I know when Oriana Fallaci had her interview with him, she wore the chador and then, as I recall, ripped it off in the middle of the interview and refused to wear it any longer. But I think that was part of how she got in to talk with him.
I never made that big a deal out of having to wear a headscarf in Ayatollah Khomeini's presence. I mean, we even had to wear headscarves to go see him in Paris. And I guess we could have made a political statement and tried to fight it, but then we wouldn't have gotten access to the story. And my feeling is, you know, if Ayatollah Khomeini is a religious leader and if he feels better having a woman be dressed in a headscarf, then I will respect that because he's a religious leader. I was Rome bureau chief for Newsweek for 3 years and traveled with the Pope. Now, I would never wear a red dress traveling on the Pope's flight, and I'd never wear a sleeveless dress. And it was just, I'd never wear a really short skirt. Now, it wasn't that I would be thrown off the plane, but just as a mark of respect towards a religious leader. I mean, you can't even get into the Vatican if you've got shorts on.
How did you end up specializing in the Middle East?
It was really by chance. As I told you earlier, I was based in Paris for Newsweek magazine. The first time I ever went to the Middle East, it was to cover a wedding. It was to cover King Hussein's wedding because they wanted a woman to cover the wedding. And they needed someone to describe Queen Noor's Christian Dior dress with the white crepe dress with the faggoting around the neckline. And that was my first trip. And my second entree into the Middle East was Ayatollah Khomeini. It was because of him that I got to know Iran, and that was how I became a quote-unquote Iran specialist, as we all become specialists very quickly in our profession.
Elaine Shalino, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Elaine Shalino is a reporter for The New York Times and the author of the new book, The Outlaw State, Saddam Hussein's Quest for Power and the Gulf Crisis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Kitty Kelly biography of Nancy Reagan recently created a media storm, diverting attention away from the other new Reagan book, President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime, by journalist Lou Cannon. Coming up, a talk with Cannon about Reagan's performance as president. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Thelma and Louise, starring Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to reports on Israeli and Army radio stations, Israeli Prime Minister Shamir has sent a negative reply to a letter from President Bush concerning a Middle Eastern peace conference. These reports quoted both U.S. and Israeli sources as saying that the Prime Minister told Mr. Bush that Israel would not allow the U.N. a role in a proposed conference. Israel has said that any meeting must be a one-time gathering, followed by peace talks between Israel and individual Arab states. Meanwhile, a Bush administration official says that there is no contradiction between its efforts to limit sales in the Middle East and its plans to sell fighter jets and attack helicopters to countries in that area. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
Just last week, President Bush unveiled his long-awaited plan to limit arms sales in the Middle East, including an eventual ban on surface-to-surface missiles. Since then, the administration has proposed selling fighter jets to Israel and attack helicopters to the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Undersecretary of State Reginald Bartholomew told a Senate panel today there is no contradiction between those sales and the new policy.
It is not aimed at preventing peaceful nations from having the ability to defend themselves. It is not aimed at stopping the legitimate transfer of arms.
There are several proposals in Congress to limit arms sales in the Middle East. One attached to the foreign aid bill may come up in the House next week. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell has now added his voice to a growing chorus of congressional Democrats who believe that U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburg should resign immediately because of his upcoming Senate race. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
This week, Thornburg announced that he is going to run for the Senate in Pennsylvania and that he will step down from his Justice Department post in July. Yesterday, several Democratic leaders in Congress, including the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, said that Thornburg should resign immediately. They said it would be inappropriate for him to continue as the nation's top law enforcement officer while he is a political candidate. Democratic members of Congress and private congressional watchdog groups have suggested that by staying at the Justice Department, Thornburg is putting himself in the situation where he could easily encounter conflict of interest problems. Thornburg is running for the Senate seat formerly held by Republican John Hines. Hines died in a plane crash in April. The seat is currently being held by a Democrat, Harris Wofford, who was appointed by Pennsylvania's Democratic governor after Hines' death. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Also on Capitol Hill, the House has just voted to restore funding for the Space Station Project. The vote was 240 to 173. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 10 points to close at 2,994.86. This is NPR News. According to a new government study, the country's children are not learning the math they need for either college or work. The National Assessment of Education Survey, known as the nation's report card, found only 46% of the nation's high school seniors could handle levels of math usually taught in the seventh grade. Albert Shanker, president of the American Federation of Teachers, says this report found that U.S. students tend to do well in basic skills, but in more complex problems continue to fall short of world-class standards. Libya appears to have made an effort to improve its hostile relations with the West. It's donated over $400,000 to a British police charity 7 years after a shot from the Libyan People's Bureau in London killed a British policewoman. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
Days after policewoman Yvonne Fletcher was killed, Britain severed diplomatic relations with Libya and they have not been restored. Today's news comes from British Member of Parliament Teddy Taylor, who has just returned from Libya, where he had an hour-long meeting with Colonel Gaddafi. He said that the Libyan leader expressed regret for the killing and that he sensed a change of mood in Gaddafi's attitude to the West.
I found he was a very deep person who seemed to be anxious to convey the simple fact that there had been a change of policy on the part of Libya.
The British government said today that this gesture alone is not enough to restore diplomatic relations. But further evidence suggesting an end to Libya's confrontation with the West comes in a joint statement between Italy and Libya condemning chemical weapons. The Italian said it's the first time that Colonel Gaddafi has made such a statement. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
A number of major U.S. retailers say that sales were up last month, with discount chains leading the way. One economist said the gain was pretty much as expected, with stronger-than-predicted sales by Walmart. Officials say that discount store sales were up 11% and department store sales were up 4%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Ronald Reagan was in the White House, his schedule often set aside 2 or 3 hours a day to staff time, a phrase that some considered a euphemism for nap time. A joke circulating among the press was that Reagan's best-known movie had been reissued under the title Staff Time for Bonzo. This is one of many stories Lou Cannon tells in his new book, President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. It's Cannon's third book about the former president. Lou Cannon covered Ronald Reagan throughout his political career. Cannon covered the California campaigns and Reagan's first term as governor for the San Jose Mercury News. Cannon covered Reagan's years in the White House for the Washington Post. I asked Cannon if he liked Reagan more as a man than as a president.
I like Reagan, of course. Most people who deal with him personally do. He's a decent, unassuming man. I thought he was... My conclusion in my book is that he's a great American but not a great president, that the role was a little too big for him. I think he did some things well, and I give him great credit for driving a stake through the heart of the Cold War, because when Ronald Reagan brings in a treaty and says Gorbachev's a different kind of Soviet leader, even anti-communist Americans tend to believe him. We've taken a lot of steam out of the great sort of emotional virus that existed in the body politic since the end of World War II, which was this fervent kind of anti-communism that animated the Cold War. I give Reagan a lot of credit for that. I think he didn't understand enough. When you got him off his core agenda, and you had a situation that you couldn't decide by ideology or script, Lebanon being a classic example, that Reagan was in over his head. I think he didn't understand, frankly, the difficulty of trying to do something structurally about the deficit, that if you were going to reduce taxes, which he wanted to do and did, and build up the military, which he wanted to do and did, that the only way you were going to balance the budget was, as John Anderson said in 1980, with mirrors. But I think that it wasn't a question so much of him not being qualified for president as he was limited. He was a great performance president. He believed in the performance aspect of the presidency. He thought it hadn't been done very well by Carter and Ford. I think he was right in that. He thought he could do it better, and he was right, he did. But when the cameras weren't rolling and the lights weren't on, he wasn't the decisive leader that he seemed to be in public, and that's where I fault him.
How was he prepped for press conferences where he had to speak extemporaneously, or at least give the appearance of it? I mean, he couldn't tell for sure what questions were going to be asked in advance.
Well, he was prepped by these wild rehearsals that they did in the family theater. I think I quote Pat Buchanan in the book saying that contrasting the preparation for of Nixon and of Reagan. Nixon was a very structured guy, and he didn't particularly like people. He knew a lot of things, and they'd go through these intricate written sort of interrogatories. Reagan, who liked people a lot, you'd have people sort of batting questions around. I think that a couple of things about the Reagan press conferences. One is that the course that Reagan followed on his infrequent press conferences was not, it seems to me, written in the stars. Reagan started out, I think he was going to have fairly regular press conferences. After the assassination attempt, and he was seriously wounded, and it was a little more than 2 months into his presidency, He was unable for a long time to do anything except respond in a ceremonial way. And he didn't have a press conference. I can't remember whether it was to June or August, but until that summer. He didn't prepare for it very well. And he answered a lot of questions poorly, and he got rapped for it by people who were usually sympathetic to him. I remember Bill Sapphire wrote a very biting column about Reagan skimping on his preparation. And Reagan, after that, sort of played defense. They held these news conferences as infrequently as possible, and it meant that there was no way that you could get Reagan up for the news conference, because if you were trying to brief him on what happened in 5 months, you couldn't begin to anticipate what would happen. Now, I say he could have been better than he was, because I had the experience with him in Sacramento, where he held nearly weekly news conferences, and he was just dreadful when he started. He was pretty good, though, after a couple of years of doing it, because he was a performance-oriented person. That's the way he'd been raised. That's what his background was as an actor. And if Reagan had done kind of weekly news conferences, I think he would have become good at them. But his staff was too afraid of that, and it fed on itself. And after a while, a news conference for Reagan became simply an ordeal to get through.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Luke Cannon, and while Reagan was in the White House, he covered the White House and Reagan presidency for the Washington Post. His new book about Reagan, which is his third book on Reagan, is called President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Luke Cannon is my guest, author of a new book called President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. We've been reading these new revelations about the arms for hostage deal that was made during the Reagan-Bush campaign, and that, you know, a deal was made, or the theory goes, a deal was made with the Iranians to free the hostages, but to not free them until the election was won and the inauguration was over. Do you think that that's going to prove to be true after further investigation?
I don't, although I've in my columns supported further investigation of it and do. That's a recurrent accusation. I looked at it myself in this is my third book on Reagan, and a book that I wrote on Reagan a decade ago, my second book on it. I tell you, I don't think it's so for a number of reasons. For one thing, I have a lot of respect for Lloyd Cutler, who was the White House counsel during the Carter years, and he was heavily involved in the negotiations, and he doesn't think it's true. And I think that if Lloyd Cutler felt that it was, I would certainly pay a lot of attention to it. Secondly, Gary Sick, who made these allegations in a New York Times piece that sort of raises again, said that he hadn't believed it was true for a number of years and now had changed his mind. Well, the fact is that in 1988, he said the same thing in the middle of the campaign. He said, now I think it's true. I think that the Carter people have never wanted to think that Reagan won that election fair and square, and so we've sort of got a kind of a conspiracy theory that's come up now when Bill Casey is dead. Anybody who reads my book will know that I think that Bill Casey was capable of doing anything, but I don't think there's been nothing to the substance of this allegation. It's so easy to make an accusation against Kennedy or Nixon or Reagan or Carter, but I think the burden of proof is upon those who make it, and there's been no evidence for it. The other reason, I guess, I think that my gut sort of tells me it isn't true, although I certainly think it ought to be investigated, is that I don't see what was in it for the Iranians. What was supposed to be in it for the Iranians was that the Israelis would start shipping them arms again. Well, the Israelis shipped arms to the Iranians at every chance they got. They stopped for a while when our hostages were, but they started up again right afterwards. And clearly, it didn't matter who was in the White House. That was the policy they were following because they thought it was in their own interest. I don't see why that Iran would have wanted Reagan to come to power. In fact, I think the historical evidence suggests that they did not.
How much do you think Reagan knew about the Iran-Contra affair?
Oh, well, you got to separate the two of them. First of all, in the Iran, you don't have any Iran-Contra affair, and if you don't have the sale of arms to Iran, and the responsibility for that is solely at Reagan's doorstep. Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Weinberger didn't agree on very many things. Weinberger cracked afterwards that it shows what happened when we agree. We should never agree. Reagan did that, and he did it, by the way, Terry, to free. He really identified with the plight of the people who were held captive, Americans held captive in Lebanon. And whatever you can say about Ronald Reagan is he wouldn't have for one day wanted any one of them to be held one day longer than was necessary. In fact, he felt their plight so deeply that it got in the way of the sensible policy that his administration had proclaimed, which was no arms for hostages, because the reason for that policy was that if you started doing it, you were going to have happen exactly what happened in the Iran-Contra affair. People would release some hostages, but once they became currency, they'd take more. Now, on the Iran part of it, it's more complicated. Reagan could certainly pass a lie detector test on the question of whether or not he's always said he didn't know about that, the diversion, and he believes that he didn't know about the diversion. Bud McFarlane, I quote him in my book, thinks that it's quite likely that Poindexter briefed Reagan, but briefed him kind of on the fly or on the cuff, as McFarlane himself had often done, and that Reagan simply wasn't paying attention, or I think that's possible. There's two aspects to that diversion, though. One is the profiteering that people like Secord, you know, posing as a patriot, did. Reagan was genuinely appalled at that. That's something he certainly didn't know and wouldn't have allowed. But on the other question of sending these arms and stuff to the Contras, people like Oliver North, who was a zealot but not a profiteer, was saying that he was doing what he thought Reagan wanted done. Reagan's instructions to McFarlane had been to keep the Contras together body and soul, and I think that Reagan bears a great responsibility for that, for the Contra part of it as well, because it certainly was reasonable that the people who were supplying the Contras thought they were doing what Reagan wanted done in view of his statements. Of course, he didn't keep track of it, but he didn't keep track of very much that went on in the White House.
I want to ask you a few things about yourself and about your new book. Now, your book came out at the same time as the Kitty Kelly biography of Nancy Reagan came out. How did that affect you, you know, in terms of how the book was reviewed and where it was reviewed, if it was reviewed with her book or not?
Well, it certainly affected my publisher. It's the same publisher. It told me that Kitty Kelly's book was coming out later, and I wish they had been right in what they said to me. And it certainly did affect it in the way you just suggested, in that they were reviewed at the same time. And there's a lot of bookstores in this country where they've got sold a lot more copies of the Kitty Kelly book, which has got a certain easy notoriety about it. But I hope that in the long run, it isn't going to have much impact at all.
You've interviewed Reagan many times. I'm wondering what he's like to interview and how his memory was when you would talk to him. If he would charm you with anecdotes but not be very forthcoming about information, if he would ever doze off like you said he did in another meeting that he once had.
Well, he was pretty careful not to doze off in interviews.
Right.
Reagan's a difficult interview. He's a difficult interview because he's perfectly charming, but he doesn't tell you very much about himself. you know, when you get into Reagan anecdote, I've likened it. It's likened it to you hit a cassette. If you hit the wrong cassette, you hit the button, and then the record plays at you. So the Reagan interviews were in truth, Terry, they were hard going, but they were usually worth it for me.
Hard going because you couldn't get past the anecdote, the much told anecdote.
Yeah, not just the anecdote. The anecdote. Hard going because you couldn't get by the sort of canned answer. You know, the Reagan rarely let his hair down in interviews, and kind of talked from his gut. He usually gave you this kind of scripted answer, and he'd always tell you a story as if you might have heard it 100 times, but like you were the first person in the world that he'd ever told it to you. That could be frustrating. But I've been interviewing Reagan a very, very long time. I started interviewing him for my first book in 68. And I guess I appreciate the fact that after all I'd written about him, he was still willing to sit down with me. And I learned something from each of these interviews with him.
Well, Lou Cannon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Lou Cannon, reporter for The Washington Post. He covered President Reagan during his California political career and through his years in the White House. Cannon's new book is called President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight we'll be talking with Rick Lyman, a Philadelphia Inquirer reporter who's been to 2 refugee camps in Ethiopia in the Ogaden Desert. These are refugees from Somalia who have left that country after the revolution there a few months back. There are said to be 500,000 refugees at risk of starvation or dying of thirst. My colleague Robert Siegel has a preview of this Saturday's National Victory Celebration in Washington. Congress takes up the issue of arms sales to the Middle East. Also, we'll be reading letters from listeners. And this evening, correspondence about hyperthyroidism and ugly Americanism.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the new movie Thelma and Louise, Gina Davis plays a housewife and Susan Sarandon plays a waitress, but they're both transformed when they hit the road. Film critic Stephen Schiff says Thelma and Louise is something new in American movies.
It's a man's world, they say, but no movie has ever demonstrated it with quite as much conviction and spirit as Thelma and Louise. This is an exhilarating road picture, a crime spree picture, and a buddy picture, too, but the buddies are 2 women. Sweet, innocent Thelma, played by Gina Davis, and her tough, world-weary pal Louise, played by Susan Sarandon. When they leave their husband and lover, respectively, for a wild weekend in Louise's 66 T-Bird, the universe they go soaring into belongs quite blatantly to men. The director, Ridley Scott, fills each gas station and diner with flexing bodybuilders and mean-looking cowboys. Everywhere the women go, big, scary trucks honk, oil wells pump, smokestacks belch and gushers gush. Like Bonnie and Clyde before them, Thelma and Louise are outlaws. But what dooms them to be outlaws is their womanhood. In this movie, the moment an American woman steps out the door, from the inside world of home and hearth to the lean, mean outside, she's in alien territory. Ridley Scott's sunstruck imagery is powerful enough to make even a male viewer feel the unearthliness our sex has created on Earth. Yet as Thelma and Louise pass through the eerie canyonlands of Utah and Arizona, Scott also shows how the twisted man-made landscapes are not so different from the twisted natural landscapes, as though man's dominion over the planet were part of some terrible cosmic plan. That's enough to make a woman feel even more lost and alone out there, and yet Thelma and Louise isn't a feminist harangue. It's an exuberant party of a movie, and it's great fun. At first, though, you don't think it will be. As our 2 heroines prepare for their journey, they come across as just a couple of ditzes from Arkansas, and their banter feels pokey and staid. Then Thelma, that's Gina Davis, decides they ought to drop into a tough-looking bar. And that's when, much to Louise's chagrin, Thelma starts to cut loose.
I have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma!
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it? I mean, God, you're as bad as Daryl.
I'm sorry, it's just I'm not used to seeing you this way. I haven't seen you this way in a while. You're usually so sedate.
Well, I've had it up to my ass with sedate. You said you and me was going to get out of town and for once just really let our hair down. Well, darling, look out, because my hair is coming down.
A moment later, the movie kicks into a higher gear. Thelma starts drinking in earnest and dancing with a good-looking ne'er-do-well named Harlan. When Harlan takes her out into the parking lot and tries to rape her, Louise shoots him. But now, instead of going all glum and earnest, the movie gleefully erupts. Thelma and Louise get more and more daring, and more criminal, and pretty soon they've got Detective Harvey Keitel on their tail, along with the FBI and the police forces of three states. At this point, you might think the movie would start trying your credulity, and I suppose at times it does, but it never tries your patience. First-time screenwriter Callie Curry has written a script that gets funnier and more biting as it goes along, and she manages to flesh out even the most luridly chauvinistic of her male characters, making them nearly as poignant and convincing as the women. Davis and Sarandon each give the performance of a lifetime here, and Scott's camera feasts on them. He seems to be exulting in everything from their crow's feet to their billowy red hair. The very sight of these women bulleting through Utah's famously phallic valleys, the setting of so many macho John Ford westerns where men are men and women are nothing, that sight amounts to a small revolution. And Thelma and Louise feels like one.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with associate producers Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sharrock. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, he's the top. We commemorate the 100th anniversary of Cole Porter's birth with a concert by singer Barbara Lee. You'll hear some of your Porter favorites and some of his equally wonderful but lesser-known songs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.